in an unprecedented way, we see all of the governments around the world, with very few exceptions, all adopting the same policy at the same time frame. Right? This tells us that this is a highly coordinated effort, right, internationally, and it tells us that there is a group of people or individuals who are directing the governments essentially what to do. Right? And so this is very compatible with, you know, this globalist agenda moving towards a one world government and with tighter control over the population, with a reduced population, with a new financial monetary and currency system. And there's evidence for all these aspects. And I think the overall plan has been well laid out in the United Nations document, Agenda 21, later changed to Agenda 2030. There are many other supporting documents, like you mentioned, the Rockefeller document, and there are several others that essentially give all the details to this plan, and they all correlate with the policies that are taking place right now.
What is your take on this brand new experimental RNA-DNA vaccine, which contains nanotechnology, which of course some of these projects are being funded by not only Bill Gates, pretty much in all of them, but also the Department of Defense and DARPA, as the vaccine manufacturers are rushing faster than ever before, admittedly, they boast about it, with rolled back regulations and zero liability. This to me sounds like a recipe for disaster.
They basically want to inject genes into us, and they are using this procedure called electroporation, where they apply an electric current through two extra needles with the vaccine that create little holes in our cells that allow the DNA to go inside our own cells. And then they are supposed to then make foreign proteins that supposedly generate immunity. But all I can describe this as is they want to make us into genetically modified organisms, because this is the exact same procedure that they would be using to make any other genetically modified organism.
We have seen your message get censored a lot. You know, videos, many videos that you've been in have been taken down. And by speaking out, you're essentially, you know, risking your reputation, risking your career. Why would you take that risk?
Well, Spiro, because this is the only important thing for me to do now is get this information out so that we can prevent ourselves from living in a horrible, horrible future. And, you know, I have two young children, and they are my main motivating factor, that I don't want them to live in a world where they have no freedom. And that's where we're headed right now. And so whatever risks there are, they're risks that I simply have to take.
Welcome everyone, I'm Spiro, thanks for tuning in. And joining me today is Dr. Andrew Kaufman, who is a natural healing consultant, an inventor, public speaker, forensic psychiatrist, and expert witness. He completed his psychiatric training at Duke University Medical Center after graduating from the Medical University of South Carolina and has a BS from MIT in molecular biology. He has conducted and published original research and lectured, supervised, and mentored medical students, residents, and fellows in all psychiatric specialties. He has been qualified as an expert witness in local, state, and federal courts. He has held leadership positions in academic medicine and professional organizations. He ran a startup company and to develop a medical device that he patented and invented. Dr. Kaufman, I've had many requests to have you on. Thank you for taking the time to join me today.
Thank you, Spiro. It's great to be with you.
Now, I want to do something a little different today. There's so much conflicting information out there. People are having a hard time knowing what to believe, deciphering what, you know, is credible and what is not credible. I don't know that any of us really have all of the answers at this point, but we've all been looking at this very closely, especially given the fact that oftentimes official statements coming from government sources and so-called medical health experts, they keep changing. Now, I personally have a hard time believing anything that the establishment says at face value, given they have a long track record of lying to us. Now, that being said, I would like to include some questions from the viewers, and recently I put out on social media asking people to submit their questions to you, Dr. Kaufman, and there was a quite a large response. But before we get into taking the questions from the viewers, I wanted to get your take on this current coronavirus situation in general. At the beginning of this, we were told the projections were going to be very bad with a high mortality rate, which justified the lockdowns, and were all based on computer models, which just so happened to be funded by none other than Bill Gates. But now we have actual data to work with. So what does the data tell us? Should people be concerned?
That's a very good question. And the data is very difficult to interpret because there are a lot of purposeful errors in the data. Like, for example, with all of the instructions to put COVID-19 as the cause of death on death certificates, even when in many conditions that it is not related to the cause of death. And this comes, you know, directly from the CDC and other health agencies. So what I've done is, in order to take this error out of the consideration, is just to look at the overall mortality from all causes and compare that to previous years. And actually, the CDC has a page on their website where they've done this. They've compiled the average weekly mortality from the prior 3 years and compared that to the current year-to-date mortality on a weekly basis. And I've been following that. It's updated on a daily basis, and every week a week is added. And essentially what it's shown is that there is roughly the same amount of people dying this year, slightly less according to their statistics, currently 2% less than last 3 years on average. So what this tells me is that there's actually no indication of a new illness causing any excess mortality, despite however it's labeled. And I know we're going to talk about the tests in more detail, but the tests are not measuring a virus and are not accurate in terms of how they correlate with disease. And in fact, there's been no error rate calculated at all for the tests. So my opinion overall is that this pandemic is a completely manufactured public relations marketing operation. And there's actually no virus, no disease, but there are major changes in government policies in virtually all areas of public policy. As we know, of course, limiting our individual freedoms, but also the financial consequences, the food supply chain, the telecommunications infrastructure, and the list goes on and on.
Well, a little bit later on, I definitely would like to get into a bit more of the agenda, which definitely appears, I would agree with you, to be attached to this crisis. Going off of the data that you referenced there, right off of the CDC website, is pretty astounding to see that despite the fact of the media and government sensationalism of this quote-unquote crisis, that the death rate is down, which would indicate that we're not being told the truth. But to outright say that there is no new illness, what will we say then when we see like these clusters of deaths, for example, at nursing homes and elderly people's homes?
Well, normally people are dying all the time. And now what we see is that the hospital beds are essentially closed to people with non-COVID related illness. So people are not going to the hospital and they're dying at other places instead of the hospital. So whereas, you know, nursing home patients in the past, when they are ill, they would be sent to the hospital and most likely they would die there. Now they're dying in the nursing home. The same thing with elderly and infirm people living in the community. They would normally in past years be going to the hospital when they got worse and would most likely die there when their time comes. And now we're seeing those people dying at home in the community. So it gives the perception that there's a new illness and that people are dying in places that we don't normally see. And it makes it appear as if they're dying in higher numbers. But that's not actually what the CDC's own data collection shows.
Now, I'd like to get more into the testing, as we've had many questions from the viewers considering the fact that the testing will likely be used to control people's movements and ability to interact in society. Now, I have a question here from at Thomas P. Webster. Many of us want to know about the actual test for COVID-19. What does the test actually test for specifically? Will the test show positive for any coronavirus? And how reliable is this testing? And I think that these are great questions here, because it's my understanding that the test was actually created long before this new or novel coronavirus came onto the world stage.
Well, yeah, so the test is kind of a big quagmire, and it's definitely not reliable. And in fact, we don't really know exactly what it's testing for. So the main test that is being used is this PCR test, or technically RT-PCR, which is used to amplify small strands or small amounts of strands of RNA. That means that it's not testing for a virus. And in fact, there's been no virus that has been isolated from any samples of any patients with a respiratory illness. They have made claims as such, but I can certainly explain in detail that they didn't actually find a virus. But the way I understand they developed this PCR test is that they took samples of lung fluid from some sick individuals initially in China, and they basically reconstructed a sequence of RNA through a process where they combine short strands of RNA by a method called alignment, and sort of reconstruct what they call a viral genome. Now, normally, if you wanted to obtain the genome of a virus, right, and this has been done, for example, for bacteriophages, which are perhaps misrepresented but have been called a virus that infects bacteria, what they would do is isolate and purify the bacteriophage particles. And then once they're in a pure state with no contamination, they could then do a chemical characterization of the structure of those particles. And that would include extracting the genetic material and performing a full sequence of the genetic material to obtain an entire genome. And that's been done for bacteriophages. But that's not what has been done for this SARS-CoV-2 virus that they allege to have identified in these studies. Instead, what they've done is taken an impure sample of lung fluid and not purified it at all, but just used PCR probes looking for specific sequences that they've already identified as being related to viruses, and then using that to reconstruct bits of DNA and combining them into a model that they say represents the genome or the entire set of genetic material of this virus. But since they didn't obtain it from a purified viral particle, there's really no way to know exactly what the source of that genetic material is. But most of the genetic material that would be present in the lung fluid of an ill individual would be our own genetic material, and also that of other microorganisms that normally live in our body or were involved in an infectious process in those people. So these could easily represent strands of RNA that are human and that are bacterial. But the thing is, we just really don't know, because it's never been compared to something that was obtained directly from a purified virus. So it's measuring these RNA strands of unknown significance. And the way that they allege that this is a coronavirus family, and in fact they say it's related to SARS-CoV-1, which is the virus that they used the same procedures, by the way, to say was the cause of the SARS outbreak in 2003. So they basically looked at the sequence that they reconstructed by this artificial method and compared it to the sequence that they reconstructed by the same artificial method from the SARS-CoV-1 virus, and say that they're almost 80% identical. Therefore, they are part of the same coronavirus family, or they're related. Now, just to contrast that, when you compare the entire genetic sequence of humans versus chimpanzees, they're 96% identical. So that's much higher. And yet you wouldn't say that we are chimpanzees or the chimpanzees are humans. So they're relating these sequences together that are reconstructed arbitrarily and saying, because of this 80% identity, that it's a coronavirus and related to SARS-CoV-1. So it's a huge stretch by any stretch of the imagination. I mean, there's no way really to confirm that this is a real entity or really related to something else, that also we don't know if it's a real entity at all. So when you subject yourself to this test, you're basically, and this is without considering any of the pitfalls of the PCR method itself, right, which there are some. So even without considering that, you just don't know exactly what you're measuring. And so in some field tests where they've tried to use mathematical models to calculate an error rate, they've come up with a number like 80% false positive. So that means, you know, 4 out of 5 people with a positive test don't even have what they say that they have.
Thus, inflating the numbers on another scale. Now, when you say, you know, they removed this genetic material from the lungs, you know, can you tell us about who was involved in this process, when, you know, where it took place, and is this, they only did it, you know, like once, and this is the standard now? I mean, shouldn't there be, I don't want to say a fact checking, but I mean, shouldn't there be processes in place to, re-verify this? I mean, if it is such a serious global health pandemic crisis, you know, wouldn't we want to have like a peer-reviewed, type of a test?
Well, it goes even deeper than that, Spiro, because they didn't even do a control group. So, you know, one of the basic rules of doing a scientific experiment is that you have a negative control group so you can isolate the effects of a single variable, right? And in this case, the variable would be the genetic material from a virus from a sick person, right? So what they could have done is taken the lung fluid from people who did not have the illness and make sure that they don't find the same genetic sequence in those people. Right. And this is a very standard thing. Like every time I've done any kind of experiment that was going to be published, there was always had to be a control group. And they didn't do this basic step. There's no control group. But if they would have done that, most likely they would have found the same genetic sequence in that control group of healthy people's lung fluid. So that would have been really useful. Now, of course, you need to also do this with more patients. Right. So the original study comes from China. Where they examined the lung fluid from patients from the food market in Wuhan. Okay, but they only had 9 patients and they could only extract this material from 7 of the 9. And that's the total set. So it wasn't like they had 250 cases, for example, which would give it a lot more validity. Then the same exact procedure has been done several times since then in different places. But to my recollection, it's only been done with a single patient. Right, that's been done in Korea. There's a group in Canada who haven't published yet. And there's one other publication I can't recall where it's from off the top of my head. But essentially, they've done the same exact procedure in all those different studies and have gotten slightly different genetic sequences, by the way. But they say that that's explained by the virus is mutating.
Well, it seems like, for being such a serious situation that, as we're told, that there would be a lot more, fail safes put into place, or, double checking of work and as you stated, basic scientific methods and approaches that should be applied here. One of them you talk about is Koch's postulates, which you have gone through several different reports and studies that were published claiming to have gone through this standardized method to verify some of this information. And could you tell us a little bit about what you found?
Yeah, absolutely. So there was a paper in 2003 that claimed to satisfy Koch's postulates for the SARS-CoV-1 virus, right, which they relate to this current alleged virus. It was really fascinating how this played out. But let me just remind everyone that Koch's postulates are a set of rules put forth by the proponents of germ theory, because what we're really talking about is germ theory, right, which says that some agent of a microorganism outside of your body comes in and invades and causes disease. So these are kind of some common sense rules that you should basically have a disease that's identifiable, be able to extract a microorganism that's the cause from the people sick with that disease, but not from people who are healthy. And then you can isolate that infectious agent out of the sick people, and you can give it to a healthy person or animal host and cause the same disease, and then also re-isolate it from them. And this was tried, attempted to be applied to viruses when they were first thought to be discovered under the electron microscope, but no one was successful at, as far as I know, even the first step of isolating the virus from people with the disease. So they tried to modify this a couple of times, and the one modification was based on an article from Thomas Rivers. And he basically reasoned that it was too difficult to prove Koch's postulates for viruses, so we should ease up on some of the criteria. And so in that 2003 article that I mentioned, although in the title of it says Koch's postulates were satisfied, in the first or second paragraph, it said that they actually used Rivers criteria, which was an adaptation of Koch's postulates. So right there, you see fraud in how this information is represented. They also misinterpreted Rivers' paper and synthesized six criteria, but really they weren't six criteria talked about in the Rivers paper. And then they mentioned that the first three of the six were satisfied by these other publications. And so I looked at those, and they followed the same exact procedure that I described for SARS-CoV-2, which didn't isolate any virus. So basically the first criterion or the second criterion of Rivers was not satisfied. And then, of course, they didn't actually satisfy any of the other criteria. One of them is quite simple, actually. It's filterability. And that's really important to purify a virus particle because it's much smaller than all of the other cells, and you can purify it substantially just by putting it through a filter. And this is never done in the studies that claim to isolate a novel virus.
So basically at this point, they have not met the standardized procedure to isolate this particular SARS-CoV-2, COVID-19, which is referred to as, virus. So therefore, what you're saying is we don't even know for sure if it exists because they haven't been able to prove it. And then we see that the testing itself is flawed in many ways, not only giving false positives, but the method in which they are testing does not really make sense scientifically. And correct me anytime that if I'm wrong. I'm not a scientist or a doctor. And then what you're saying is through Koch's postulates, which is meant to prove beyond a shadow of a doubt and replicate or reproduce a virus, has never been accomplished before for any virus ever. So would that call into question viruses themselves, like in their existence? And if that's the case, then how do you explain when people get sick? You know, like when they catch the flu or, you know, they just feel like crap. I mean, we all thought it was viruses, right? What can you tell us?
Yeah, Spiro, so you're hitting all the important points. And yeah, so let me just correct that satisfying Koch's postulates actually doesn't even prove beyond a shadow of a doubt. It just gives you a fair degree of certainty. And it's never been satisfied for any of these viruses. So, and it's true, like I haven't seen evidence for one virus that this has been satisfied, and other researchers who have looked into this perhaps more in depth than I have also not found any example where it's been satisfied or even come close to being satisfied. So this is, you know, what I consider dogma, really, but it's been perpetuated. And I think, you know, I'm not saying that there's a conspiracy that all these scientists are in on. I think they just grow up in this system and learn these techniques and are being basically told that this is how you prove this virus exists, right? And it's based really on this theoretical model that's pieced together from little strands of genetic material into a theoretical model, but they never actually have the purified structure of the virus where they can show you exactly what it looks like on a photograph and then where they can show the chemical structure of it. Instead, they're just essentially basing all that information on a theoretical model that they've never shown experimentally. And I think that most of the scientists that come up, you know, that's the way they're taught to do it. Then they get their papers published and then they get job offers and they get to defend their thesis successfully. And they're basically part of that system and they keep perpetuating these procedures forward. And I haven't seen more than one or two examples of a virologist actually questioning this with respect to what about just how come we don't have a control in our experiments, right? A basic principle of scientific method is to have a control. And so they basically are just kind of going along and not really thinking about it critically. And that's how this kind of dogma is perpetuated. From the point of view of us as like regular people and citizens, and you know, even the scientists grow up this way from a very young age. You know, we're taught that we pass germs to each other and that's how we get sick and we need to cover our mouth and nose, right? And be very careful to stay away from other people when we're sick. So we kind of perpetuate this model that we think, you know, there are germs out there trying to come and get us. And, you know, one of the main corollaries of if there are germs out there trying to come and get us, well, what can we do? We can't do anything, right? All we can do is rely on the experts to give us, you know, germ killing chemicals, right?
Yeah. And so this would, so what exactly, for example, are they doing, you know, with these bioweapons programs, you know, and they're weaponizing germs is how I understand it, you know, at places like Fort Detrick, which just so happened to be shut down prior to this whole outbreak taking place. And there was a lot of mystery, you know, respiratory illnesses taking place, that some of it was blamed on vaping, for example, here in the U.S. just prior to, this was last summer, just prior to, you know, heading into fall flu season, when those numbers kind of just, that mystery respiratory illness just disappeared, and then all of a sudden the flu showed up, supposedly. It's kind of coincidental or synchronistic there. And then right after that is when we started to, you know, the World Military Games took place, where many athletes have returned home since then and stated that they got very ill, you know, upon returning home from the World Military Games, which were held in Wuhan, China, which we're told is ground zero. And there's the level 4 bioweapons lab there in Wuhan, China. I mean, there's a lot of other stuff at play here, and a lot of people have been reporting illnesses. And so it's just, this is, I think, where it comes into play, where a lot of people, they're having a hard time wrapping their head around, you know, what is actually taking place here.
Yeah, well, I think it actually can be quite dangerous to take some of that stuff too seriously, because, you know, I'm sure that there are top secret labs that are researching all kinds of weapons, right? I have no doubt about that. But I don't have specific information, and I don't think too many other people, you know, can really get the information out about what's going on in those laboratories. But I'll tell you, if there's really no biological model for a virus that causes disease, I'm not sure what they're engineering exactly, but I imagine it would be extremely difficult to create some kind of biological organism that would cause disease, because most of the time when we have parasitic problems, they're opportunistic. They're there because there's something not right in our body, and they're actually trying to help us get rid of that, but in the process they may get out of control and cause us problems, right? But I'm not aware of any organisms that, you know, come in and take over when you're healthy. So I think that would be a really tall order, and I'm not sure that it's even possible. But if they did want to make us sick, the easiest thing would be to put toxins into our bodies. And there's many ways that this can be done, and it has been done. For example, they're putting fluoride into our water supply, which is a known toxin to the central nervous system. And even the CDC put out a guidance in the early 2000s instructing parents of newborns not to use fluoridated water to mix baby formula, because it would affect the children's neurologic development, right? Yet they put it in our water. You know, you can look what happened in Michigan with the lead pipes and the lead poisoning from the water, right? And with the vaping, you know, that's an interesting story, because initially the vaping technology was like made by a bunch of small startup companies, and they started getting successful. And actually, I think quite a number of people were able to quit smoking tobacco and switch over to that, and possibly even get completely off. And it seemed like a relatively positive change. And then the big tobacco companies started acquiring all of those little vaping companies because they were successful and started to become competition. And once that happened, and I know that there were some small companies that got squeezed out because they wouldn't sell out. And that's when you started hearing reports of people coming in with respiratory problems to the hospital, because they're probably putting the same kind of chemicals in the vaping fluid that they've been putting in tobacco products, which is responsible for almost all the tobacco-related illness. So it's hard to say, like, there may be different things going on in different places, and many of them may just be due to commercial enterprises, not necessarily a government, you know, program. But, you know, overall, getting back to the mortality figures, you know, really, we haven't seen excess mortality. So if there's any kind of strategy like this, I don't see evidence that it's been deployed. Now, am I concerned that it will be deployed with a second wave or a future part of this psychological operation? Well, yeah, absolutely, I'm concerned about that.
Well, a global health emergency or a pandemic, a viral pandemic, would be the perfect cover to carry out all sorts of nefarious programs, which we are seeing some very concerning developments being rolled out under the guise of this emergency. Absolutely, I agree with you 100% about the toxicity of our environments, of our everyday lives, everything from the water to the food to the air, our entire environment. But moving on, as many states are beginning to ease restrictions, we're told that one of the only ways that this can happen is if governments begin this widespread testing, which you have shown, you've clearly shown that is faulty, to say the least. So this widespread testing in conjunction with their contact tracing programs, which are included in House Resolution 6666, stating that they will come to people's homes, to their residences. Now, about a month ago, a World Health Organization official, Michael Ryan, said that they believe it's time for officials to start going to people's homes, determine who is ill, and remove them from their homes.
Most of the transmission that's actually happening in many countries now is happening in the household, at family level. In some senses, transmission has been taken off the streets and pushed back into family units. Now we need to go and look in families to find those people who may be sick and remove them and isolate them.
Now that is shocking, to say the least. But shortly after that, just recently, a few days ago, a California public health official in Ventura County, California, basically echoed this sentiment, removing people from their homes who they determined to be ill.
But the purpose of this program is to bring on people. We're going to start with 10 people. We may bring on up to 50 or even more as the program grows and as we see the needs for it. As we do more testing, we will find more and more people who have COVID-19. And again, we'll isolate every one of them, and we will find every one of their contacts, and we will make sure that they stay quarantined, and we'll check in with them every day. It's not just our county that's bringing more people on. There are going to be thousands of people hired who will be these contact investigators throughout the state. And this is occurring in many, many other states as well, perhaps all of the states in our country. We will be giving intensive training to these people, training not only for identifying and finding contacts, but also in terms of how to be sensitive about doing it. We also realize that as we find more contacts, some of the people we find are going to have trouble being isolated. For instance, if they live in a home where there's only one bathroom and there are three or four other people living there and those people don't have COVID infection, we're not going to be able to keep the person in that home. Every person who we're isolating, for instance, needs to have their own bathroom. And so we'll be moving people like this into other kinds of housing that we have available.
What is your view on the contact tracing program, since we've already covered the testing? And as they say right now, they're currently building an army of 20,000 members, and California will serve as the nationwide model.
Yeah, well, Spiro, first of all, I saw your reporting on this and learned a lot from it. And I actually predicted this back in early February, that they were going to be coming to our homes asking for testing and considering pulling people out of their homes to some kind of designated, you know, quarantine prison. So I've been expecting this, and I'm not surprised at all. But of course, I'm extremely concerned. I mean, this is basically the end of our freedom. These contact tracing programs have been planned. In fact, that term was coined originally in 1931. And so this is a long time coming. And in fact, even last year in May, the Royal Academy of Sciences dedicated a whole issue of their journal to basically planning this, and includes articles on how to, you know, control the population, which is what contact tracing is for. So they, you know, they took the easy way to do this, because if they just come up with a completely fake illness and get everyone to volunteer to give up all their rights, it's much easier and much less risky than unleashing some kind of poison on the population, right? That would really make people sick and die. And that would also, you know, put themselves at risk, right? How would they make themselves invulnerable? And so I think that, you know, in a sense, it's kind of a genius plot, right? But it's a very sinister genius plot. So this is the next step to further get us to volunteer, to relinquish more freedoms. And this time it's mostly about privacy. And they may say that initially, you know, they're doing it for the public health, but we don't really know what their real intention is. And I don't think that there's going to be transparency. Like, there was a contact tracing app that I think was been used for like a month, and I believe it's in Taiwan. And I saw an interview of this gentleman, and basically it would give you like a red light or a green light. And that would be if you had permission to enter your office building or use public transportation, right? So it's like these things that we have freedom of movement. Now we have to be granted a privilege based on this, right? And so let's say that you were walking down the street and you happen to walk by someone, right, who's got someone with a positive test in their home. Now you're going to be labeled, right, as at risk, and then someone's going to come to your home and want to test you. And the people that they, I mean, you showed that, right, one of the ads that they were looking for is people with military experience. So, you know, what do people in the military learn about going door to door, right? They're looking for insurgents, right? They know how to knock down doors. They know how to look for evidence in trash places, right? They know how to intimidate people. That's what they're doing in their training and experience in a military operation. So clearly there's an intention to use these types of tactics with our own citizens.
And there are multiple categories which fall under, you know, they say that they're hiring a wide range of skill sets, basically, ranging from everywhere from data entry all the way to crisis intervention. And I'm sure each one of those categories will have beneath them subcategories. I sure would like to see a breakdown of who exactly and what the crisis intervention consists of. This is beyond Orwellian. I mean, this could be, again, under the guise of this pandemic, could be used to achieve many goals, and many that we will get into here in a little bit. But, you know, one of them for this contact tracing is very concerning to me is disappearing dissidents, for example. You know, remember at the beginning of this outbreak, towards the beginning of the year, we had seen all those terrible videos coming out of China, which is extremely controlled, the information coming out of China, by the way. We all know this. We just know this to be true, right? And they're very authoritarian. There were so many videos of men in full hazmat suits with masks, goggles, gloves, everything, literally dragging people from their homes, kicking and screaming. And if you look at who is filming those videos, whoever's filming those videos is with the people who are dragging them from their homes. So how did those videos get shared around the world on social media with the tight clampdown that China has there? I think that there's a really good chance that they wanted the world to see those videos. They wanted the world to be terrified and say, oh my goodness, like, look, this could really happen. Look how bad it is. And then to normalize the idea.
Yeah.
I mean, it's very concerning.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I think that there's a very clear reason why this started off in China, because, you know, China already, as you mentioned, right, has limited freedoms and tight control of the population. So they were trying to show that by using those severe restrictions on freedom, that they could, you know, this whole idea of flatten the curve. And then they could come to a Western country and say, well, listen, you know, we don't want to do this, but since it worked in China, we have to do this. And so you're more likely to go along with it.
And this was laid out in the Rockefeller document where it has a chapter in there titled Lockstep, and it plays out a scenario depicting a global health pandemic and how China was essentially the only way to deal with this, the Chinese authoritarian clampdown model. So, I mean, that is just one example leading up to this scenario that we're currently living in right now, which indicates to me that there's much more to this. But real quick, I want to get into another question here from a viewer. This is from at MyInfoLisa. Now, she's saying that the World Health Organization claims that antibody tests, including the IgG and IgM, basically saying that they do not infer immunity. The World Health Organization has come out and said this, that even if you have the antibodies, you may not be immune to it. So how would a vaccine, which stimulates the immune system, produce antibodies? And how would how would we be immune if we were to take this experimental vaccine? And in other words, what good is the vaccine if you can catch the illness more than once?
Well, how can you have immunity to a disease that doesn't exist, Spiro? So this is all based on a false premise. So everything is false as a result of that. Okay, and that's really the way that you have to look at it to understand the truth. But I'll tell you that what they say about antibody tests has many, many fallacies. And also our whole understanding of immunity is based on the germ theory, right? That there are invaders coming to our body and our immune system is our military defense strategy, right? And they even give cells in the immune system very warfare-like names, right? Like natural killer cells is a type of immune cell. And this is all really built on a false premise. So there is no way that an antibody is going to really give you a positive answer. And even the FDA has admitted that the antibody tests should not even be used for diagnosis. You know, antibodies are a type of protein that's made by cells in our body that are part of the immune system called B cells. And they can basically recognize things that are foreign substances to our body. And this is important because foreign substances can harm our body. And in fact, if you took virtually any foreign substance and injected it into our body, then you could cause illness. So it's important that we be able to recognize when that's occurring so that we could just take efforts to remove that substance from our body. And that's what antibodies are. But antibodies are a little bit less specific than most people think. I think the common understanding is that one antibody only binds one antigen and that it can, you know, conclusively identify it. But if we look at how antibody tests are used in medicine, we see lots of inconsistencies and we see lots of false positive and negative results. So, for example, if you look at the HIV antibody test, it's been shown in many papers to have at least 60 different conditions that give you a false positive. And some of those include being vaccinated with the hepatitis B vaccine or even being pregnant after you had a first pregnancy. So they're very, very inaccurate. And they don't tell us for the SARS-CoV-2 virus, it's not been disclosed even how these tests were designed. There's not any publications in a peer-reviewed scientific literature. So all I have to go on really to evaluate them is what the FDA says, because any of the testing that's been done has been submitted privately by these companies to the FDA, and there's a delay before you can get a Freedom of Information Act request to look at what they submitted. But hopefully there'll be someone doing that as soon as the eligibility occurs.
And it seems very suspicious that they would be withholding this information, although they probably are claiming some type of proprietary, you know, information to keep their trade secrets, you know, from other people. Now, moving on to this vaccine, I have to ask, first of all, do you consider yourself to be an anti-vaccine? You know, do you have some sort of a predetermined bias, either, you know, for or against vaccines? And then second part of the question is, what is your take on this brand new experimental RNA DNA vaccine, which contains nanotechnology, which, of course, some of these projects are being funded by not only Bill Gates, pretty much in all of them, but also the Department of Defense and DARPA, as the vaccine manufacturers are rushing faster than ever before, admittedly, they boast about it, with rolled back regulations and zero liability. This, to me, sounds like a recipe for disaster.
Yeah, well, you know, vaccines already have an arrangement that they have zero product liability. And that was part of a federal law that created a special vaccine court with a very limited ability to pay out awards. And it took all of the liability from any vaccine manufacturers. So this will be nothing new. And that's the only business that I know of that has that freedom from liability, which means that basically it doesn't hurt their bottom line at all if someone dies or gets injured from their product, right? Because they're not responsible for it. So that's no way to be in business to make something therapeutic for people, which we know that all therapeutics have risk. So I don't want to put myself into a category or a label about vaccine because I think those are really political distinctions. But what I've done is I've done a lot of research and looking at vaccines. And then I have to say, firstly, that if there's no virus that's been proven to cause disease, then what would a vaccine be protecting us from? It certainly wouldn't be from a virus. So right there, just based on that, I can tell you that vaccines couldn't possibly work in the way that they are claimed to work. But I've gone much farther than that. I've looked at all of the epidemiologic evidence, which is collecting information about you know, how many cases of this disease or that disease occur from year to year. And while there's some errors in that reporting, you can still easily follow the trends. And what you'll see is that for all of the illnesses that are claimed to be disappeared by a vaccine, actually, they disappeared before the vaccine was even available. And there's been some kind of trickery that's been played upon us to believe that the vaccine was responsible for it. But there are so many examples of this, and you know, the data just comes from the government agencies, just like all the other information that I've been reporting on. On top of that, you have almost no randomized controlled placebo-controlled trials for vaccines. And that is the gold standard for any therapeutic to be approved by the FDA. And they have basically exempted that completely for vaccines. So to get a vaccine approved, all you have to do is inject it and show that someone makes an antibody, which I've already explained is very nonspecific and doesn't really tell you anything about immunity. So they've been exempted from product liability. They've been exempted from randomized controlled trials. And they've been exempted from essentially any evidence to prove that these things actually do what they say they do. So once again, they must be for a completely different purpose. Now, if we skip ahead to talk about the vaccines that are being developed for COVID-19, these are not the same technology as the prior vaccines. And I think it's quite astonishing that some of these companies like Inovio have claimed to develop a new vaccine within hours, okay, of being given this fake genetic sequence for the virus. And what they're doing is they're basically want to inject genes into us, and they are using this procedure called electroporation, where they apply an electric current through two extra needles with the vaccine that create little holes in our cells that allow the DNA to go inside our own cells. And then they are supposed to then make foreign proteins that supposedly generate immunity. But all I can describe this as is they want to make us into genetically modified organisms because this is the exact same procedure that they would be using to make any other genetically modified organism. And I don't know what property they would like to confer to us. I have some suspicions. Like, I think infertility is a major goal of this program, and that's been articulated pretty clearly by Bill Gates on several occasions. But yeah, they want to make us genetically modified organisms, and that is the purpose, in my opinion, of this vaccine program.
And I was going to, my next question for you, Dr. Kaufman, was going to be, you know, your view on the agenda, which I know is not a scientific or medical question, but just as an individual, as you're seeing this unfold like the rest of us, as this crisis unfolds and this apparent agenda is keep pushing forward, I think you pretty much answered that question, unless there's something else you'd like to add.
In an unprecedented way, we see all of the governments around the world, with very few exceptions, all adopting the same policy at the same time frame, right? This tells us that this is a highly coordinated effort, right, internationally, and it tells us that there is a group of people or individuals who are directing the governments essentially what to do, right? And so this is very compatible with, you know, this globalist agenda moving towards a one world government and with tighter control over the population, with a reduced population, with a new financial monetary and currency system. And there's evidence for all these aspects. And I think The overall plan has been well laid out in the United Nations document, Agenda 21, later changed to Agenda 2030. There are many other supporting documents, like you mentioned, the Rockefeller document, and there are several others that essentially give all the details to this plan, and they all correlate with the policies that are taking place right now. So I think if you want to know what's coming in the future and what the overall agenda is, you can simply study those documents and you'll see pretty clearly where we're at and where we're headed.
Now, we're almost done here. I know you're a busy man. You have a lot to do, and I definitely appreciate you taking the time to be here. But some of the questions that the viewers had was about the reaction from your peers in the medical industry. You know, have you people been supporting you? Have you experienced pushback? The overall sentiment of your medical peers. I know you can't speak on behalf of the entire medical community, but you know, just what you've experienced, because we have seen your message get censored a lot. You know, many videos that you've been in have been taken down, and by speaking out, you're essentially risking your reputation, risking your career. Why would you take that risk?
Well, Spiro, because this is the only important thing for me to do now is get this information out so that we can prevent ourselves from living in a horrible, horrible future. And you know, I have two young children, and they are my main motivating factor, that I don't want them to live in a world where they have no freedom. And that's where we're headed right now. And so whatever risks there are, they're risks that I simply have to take. And, that's why I'm doing what I'm doing. And there has been, things that have occurred. I have had consequences, right? I was let go from my regular psychiatry job because I refused to wear a mask. I have had several friends who are doctors or other healthcare professionals who have been very upset with me, disappointed, and who won't talk to me anymore. And I knew that those risks were part of this, right? But that's not what's important. And I'll tell you that I would be happy to risk being taken to jail as well, because I'm not going to participate in any of these measures. I don't wear a mask. I don't stay at home. I respect other people's rights to make their own choices, right? So I don't go and get in people's faces. But if anyone is willing to make eye contact and interact with me, I don't observe any social distancing, right? Any opportunity to hug someone, especially in public, I always take advantage of that, because I want to show people that actually all of these measures are really voluntary. Even Governor Cuomo has made a public statement that there's nothing that they can do to enforce any of these measures and that they are voluntary. And I would like to encourage other people to make that decision, because if we rely on the authority to give us approval of how to exercise our freedom, they're going to take more freedoms away, as they've been doing. And so while I respect people that want to go and protest, in City Hall or the state capitol, they are coming from the right point of view, but they're just asking the authority figures, the government, to give them permission when they don't need permission from the government. They have already permission because they have inalienable rights. It's not really a decision for me. It's just what I feel that I have to do to preserve the way of life and that I want to live for me and my children.
I would have to agree, and I would say I definitely respect your position on that. Myself, I have not been asking for permission to live my life, we have seen some pushback, and which is good, which is like you said. But at the same time, people, need to take their own lives into their own hands, be responsible for themselves and their own actions, and I'm not saying, take up arms at this point. I don't think that's necessary, really, at this point. Maybe until they start coming to people's houses, dragging people away or something. But, people just should be living their lives. Go open up your businesses and go, that's my personal take on it. And You know, Dr. Kaufman, I would like to thank you very much for taking the time to be here today and to answer the viewers from the questions. And I'd like to thank everyone who did submit their questions. I'm sorry we could not get to all of them here as we're approaching 1 hour already. There was close to 100 questions for you, Dr. Kaufman. So
wow.
Yes. And people, you know, I really wanted to try to include the viewers in this because we're all in this together, in this situation together. And Dr. Kaufman, I will be sure to add your YouTube channel, which you have is a link in the description. But where else can people go to follow you and your work?
Yeah, well, please go to my website. It's andrewkaufmanmd.com. And that's where, you know, I do natural healing consultations. Lots of people reach out to me with various questions. If you sign up for my newsletter, I'll keep you informed about where my videos are going to be, because like you said, a lot of them are being taken down. I still do have some good ones on my YouTube channel, but, you know, slowly one by one, they're being taken down, and I'm trying to arrange new platforms. So that's a great way to stay in touch. You could certainly find me on Facebook as well.
Great. Dr. Kaufman, thank you again very much for being my guest today. I look forward to speaking with you soon.
Same here, Spiro. Thank you.